Chapter 24. It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 24. Everything is not roses, Bulgaria. My last 2 days in Sofia were spent picnicking, which I admit sounds frivolous, but then I've never claimed I wasn't. Spring had come with us to Bulgaria, or we had come with spring. We never were sure which. And it was impossible to stay indoors listening to the witnesses before the investigation commission or poking about in the tiny shops that smelled of sheep. One morning I set out right after breakfast with a delightful, cultured Bulgarian, Mr. M. Shipkov, who worked as a translator in the office of the American Mission, and his equally delightful wife and Norbert for the Valley of the Roses, where I believe just about all the rose oil in the world is distilled. To be sure, the roses were not blooming, but we could see the country, and that was important. It was rough, mountainous country for many miles outside of Sofia, for we had to climb first, of course, over the ridge that cups the city in. The roads were sharp, curved, and full of holes, but there was evidence that the government was getting ready to improve them. Hillocks of big stone were piled on the sides of the roads, and men and young boys were sitting astride them. Breaking the big stones into small ones with sledgehammers. It seemed a slow, tedious way to build a highway, but there is scarcely any machinery in Bulgaria, and there's plenty of labor. Everybody works in Bulgaria. Everybody has to. If a person is found loitering, he is immediately arrested and sentenced to hard labor. And this, of course, is in addition to his conscripted labor and military service. The laws on this, which I found in the Official Gazette, August 30th, 1946, number 198, I was busy as I could be poking around in gazettes, are as enlightening as those on the confiscation of property. They read, Law for the Labor Mobilization of Idlers and Vagrants, Article 1. All Bulgarian citizens of both sexes, fit for labor, aged between 16 and 50, 45 for women, given over to idleness, vagrancy, or spending a great part of their time in pubs, coffee houses, bars, pastry shops, etc., shall be mobilized for obligatory public labor. Article 2. The labor of such mobilized citizens shall be for undertakings of general interest, such as construction of roads, railroads, canals, dams, with respect to the age and sex of the mobilized person. Article 4. The period for labor mobilization under the present law does not exceed 6 months. The same is not considered as regular labor or military service. Those who have not entered in some occupation of public benefit within 6 months of their liberation shall be liable to renewed mobilization. In addition to labor groups, the country was alive that morning with flocks of sheep watched by their tall sheepskin-hatted shepherds. There are actually more sheep than people in Bulgaria. In a country with a population of 7 million, there were, in 1939, the last year for which I have an official figure, 8,859,492 sheep. I understand the figure hasn't changed appreciably since then. There are also many hogs and pigs, at which I found myself staring with surprised eyes, for I had seen only 2 pigs in all of Greece, and they were both so highly prized that they were chained to stobs. Frequently, we also passed black buffaloes, pulling primitive carts and wagons. They, too, came as a surprise to me. I had thought they were all in India. But there were even more horses on the road than buffaloes. On their heads, they wore strings of baby blue beads and bright red tassels to keep off the evil spirits. Nearing the Valley of the Roses, we passed through villages more Turkish than Bulgarian. High stucco walls, arched gateways leading into courtyards, red fezes on the heads of swarthy men, and long full trousers on black-eyed women. For centuries, this land had been under the Turks, and it still bore their imprint. From the final rise, we saw, spread flatly and neatly in the long, wide trough between mountain ranges, the valley where the roses grow. Quickly, we dropped down to it to note, as we came closer, the millions of small leafless stalks marching in close rows from range to range. I had to shut my eyes to imagine them in bloom. In the heart of the valley, we visited the large distillery that once belonged, and still does, in a manner of speaking, to Mr. Shipkoff, and we poked our noses into the great copper vats into which the rose petals were poured to be distilled into oil. Though it had been 9 months or more since the last ounce of attar had been bottled there, the odor hung in the air. At a price, it stipulates, the Bulgarian government now buys all of Mr. Shipkoff's oil, the brand of which used to be world famous, and ships it wholesale to Russia, which in turn retails it at a figure many times the Bulgarian government's price to the New York and Paris markets. But don't think for a moment Mr. Shipkoff complained about this. He only answered the questions with which I plagued him. But even more interesting than the selling plan is the system the Bulgarian government has set up to gather the roses and distill the oil. A month or two before the blooming dates, the government notifies Mr. Shipkoff to get his distillery in ship-shape running order. He has to see that the vats are shining, that the machinery is overhauled, and that the big building itself is in perfect condition. Then, when the roses bloom, the government moves in its own army of pickers, distillers, bottlers, and other necessary workmen. Mr. Shipkoff has nothing to say about who they are or what they do. When they leave, they take the rose oil with them to the government's warehouses. From the distillery, we drove on to the little town of Karlova, quaint and Turkish, with an old mosque shooting minarets above its rounded dome, and then on into the mountains that sloped up behind it. When we had driven as far as we could, we took to our feet and climbed to a cascade, leaping wildly down a rocky gorge. Directly beneath the cascade, on a concrete bridge that spanned the gorge, we spread ourselves and our basket lunch. I was in ecstasy. The long, white, ruffled fall of the water, the reach and pull of the mountains for the faraway sky, the pitch and steepness and cleanness of the gray stone sides of the cut, the firs, the pine, the sun, they brim my cup over. Why return to Sofia for the night? I began to argue. Why not travel on into the mountains until we reach a village where we could spend the night and then the next day drive back a new way to Sofia? No reason at all, said Mr. Shipkoff, except we did not have police permission to go another yard. Before receiving permission for us to leave Sofia, he had outlined to the police our exact route, and now we could not change it. This was not just because of Norbert and me, the foreigners, but applied to Bulgarian citizens as well. Are we permitted to climb the mountain? Yes, Mr. Shipkoff said and grinned. So for an hour or so, we struggled up the mountain above the gorge, clinging to tree trunks, rocks, bushes. It had the slickness of a shingled roof. I longed for spikes in my shoes and pickaxes and ropes, especially when we started down and I had no brakes to prevent me from sliding headlong into the valley. But somehow we managed to stop at the top of the falls for a last long look. The water slipped thin and clear and green over the ledge, only thrashing and frothing and fuming and running its fingers through its hair when already plunging downward, it was too late. On the return trip, we gathered a considerable distance around. We traveled a considerable distance around hairpin curves and over gulches, chasms, canyons, to reach the village of Koprivshtitsa. How the peasants who found it ever found it troubled me considerably, and also how, now that they had found it, they got to and from it. They had no railroad, no river traffic, and certainly no airplane could land there. Maybe a bus goes and comes once or twice a week. I saw no sign of it, though. The houses here were Turkish in feeling, too. They sat in the rear of courts, which were surrounded by fences almost as high as the roofs, and they were painted blues and pinks and yellows. We visited one, built curiously enough of wood, which I hadn't seen before in the Balkans, and owned by an old lady with a brown face full of wrinkles and character. Proudly, she showed us the big central room with its walls and ceilings hand-painted with garlands of little red roses and green leaves, and the kitchen off the center room also hand-painted with flowers. The wide board floors were bare and scrubbed white, and the furniture was covered. I felt it was a make-believe house. The old granny kept it for show and lived in one hidden-away corner. The next morning, the Shipkoffs and I started out again to see more country, more mountains, more towns. Norbert, in spite of orders to take it easy for a while, had work to do. The commission was preparing to move on to Belgrade as administrative officers of the United States delegation, and as administrative officer of the United States delegation, he had money, visa, and transportation problems to solve. The trip the second day wasn't nearly as rugged as the day before. We traveled mostly through valleys with small patches of farms fitted into them, and I began to understand how Bulgaria supports the great majority of her people on the land. In fact, with all of her mountains, she has 89.1% of her land under cultivation, and practically all of it is divided into small plots which are owned by the peasants who work them. This high private ownership of farms, tiny and rocky, though many of them are, is the main reason the communists are having such a struggle selling their ideology to the people. The Bulgarians love their plots of land. They have tremendous pride in their crops of wheat and tobacco and broad beans. Long years ago, they formed cooperatives and legislated for land and tax reforms. So now, why should they turn to communism? As far as the vast majority can see, communism has nothing to offer them. There are no big estates in Bulgaria to be broken up and parceled out to those without land. There's no great wealth in the hands of a few to be divided among the many. The peasants prefer to struggle on, difficult as it is to make a living, and hold fast to their independence. They were in the fields this spring day, clearing up brush, getting ready for early plowing. Many women were working by the sides of their men, and they were dressed as if to dance and sing in operettas, in long skirts of many colors, sometimes trimmed with bands of gold-looking metal that twinkled blindingly in the sun, and elaborately embroidered blouses. In one curve of the road, we came upon a group crowded around mounds of earth. They were waiting for their shares of seed potatoes that government agents were distributing. Mr. Shipkoff stopped the car on a hill above a small village and asked me to get out. This village had a wide mountain stream from which it furnished Sophia her water supply, and in return, Sophia gave the peasants here electricity, free of charge. As very few villages in Bulgaria have electricity, Mr. Shipkoff felt I should see this one. All morning we kept stopping so that Mr. Shipkoff could point out sites he thought of interest. Once it was a timber mill, once children coming home over from school, and once a long way off, the spot he camped when he went hunting. Mr. Shipkoff loved the fields and woods with such a passion I got the impression that all Bulgarians loved them. At lunchtime we climbed once more into the mountains near Sokolets, and built a fire by a chucking brook that was just beginning to chip through the shell of ice and snow. Like that, we had left spring in the valley and turned back into winter. Pillows of snow lay in the shadows of boulders, in the crevices of overhanging ledges, and on the shady sides of the roads, but in all open places the ground was sheeted with mauve crocuses. While Mr. Shipkoff gathered wood for the fire, Mrs. Shipkoff and I spread rugs on the still damp ground, stretched ourselves flat upon them, and stared into the black greenness of the soaring firs. What giants they were, what strength they had, holding the blue sky with the spread fingers of their hairy hands. After eating many good things which Jean Barnes had packed for us and drinking cups of red wine to keep out the cold, we drove reluctantly back to Sophia. That evening, the stories the roommate told me of people who had been arrested and tortured to make Bulgaria safe for Russian communism seemed more ghastly than ever. Quote, "For 6 days and 6 nights he was not allowed to sit down, not allowed to sleep, but was constantly questioned hour after hour," unquote, the roommate said, speaking of a man he personally knew. "Then electric batteries were put on his head and on his feet." "Stop talking about it," I pleaded, "and they kept telling him he would never see his wife and child again," the roommate went relentlessly on. "I didn't want to hear about it, I tell you. I don't want to hear about it. I wanted to hear the cluck of the brook, the crackle of a wood fire by a sheet of mauve crocuses, the sigh of the firs. Bulgaria is a land of such natural charm and beauty, I could not bear to think of it desecrated by torture and violence. Coward that I am, I held my fingers to my ears to block out the roommate's words and cried to my heart for decency in the world. If Bulgaria could only have the four freedoms, if the whole world could only have the four freedoms." End of chapter 24.